From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin with the Atlantic Council South Asia Center and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Paul Brandis, White House correspondent with West Wing Reports, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. North Korea tested its first intercontinental ballistic missile capable of hitting the United States on July 4th, U.S. Independence Day. President Trump took his second major foreign policy trip, attending a meeting of the world's 20 largest economic powers in Hamburg, Germany. In a first stop in Poland, Trump again questioned U.S. intelligence agency findings that Russia interfered in last year's U.S. presidential elections. A month-long boycott of Qatar continued as a deadline set by Saudi Arabia and several other Arab countries passed without Qatar accepting any of their demands. And finally, in Turkey, the leader of the main opposition party and thousands of other Turks were marching from the capital Ankara to Istanbul, demanding justice for tens of thousands of Turks fired and jailed since a failed coup a year ago. So, gentlemen, let's begin with North Korea, the land of lousy options. the North Koreans fired a missile. It flew for 5,500 miles. It flew for 37 minutes. It had a very high trajectory, which suggested it, if it had not been placed on such a high trajectory, Paul, it could have gone straighter and hit the continental United States, at least hit Alaska. How terrified should we be?
Well, it's a missile that U.S. intelligence analysts, Barbara, say is something new to them. They've never seen this missile before. They were caught off guard. So that alone is a worrying sign that we didn't even know about this, and the fact that it's capable of hitting, as you say, at least Alaska. Probably further just shows how quickly they are advancing with this technology. And when you couple that with the other part of their strategic efforts, which is, of course, to miniaturize these nuclear warheads, put them on top of these missiles, it doesn't get any more threatening than that. Now, President Trump has sort of mixed signals from the administration here. I mean, the president has said that we're looking at some really, in his words, severe options. Who knows what severe? You can interpret severe to mean all kinds of things. But then Defense Secretary Mattis said, no, we're pursuing just diplomacy at this time. So the signals are mixed, but nevertheless, the North Koreans are advancing rapidly. And also backing them up, by the way, are their friends, and let's call them that, Chinese and the Russians, both of whom have veto powers in the UN Security Council and moved to block U.S. efforts there just this week. So I think it's quite troubling indeed.
Yeah, Michael, this is an old story. There was an agreement with North Korea that went from 1994 to the end of 2002, the so-called agreed framework. North Korea had no nuclear weapons. The North Koreans were also negotiating a missile deal with the Clinton administration back in 2000. And I remember well, President Clinton made a fateful decision to go for a Middle East peace agreement, an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement, rather than go to North Korea and finalize the missile deal. Boy, I wish we could roll that tape back. Since that time, we've had the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and neither of them were able to stop this program, right?
No, that's correct. And you talk about people wanting to roll back the tape. I've heard people talking this week about wanting to roll back the tape clear back to MacArthur, you know, and really let him march on Pyongyang. That was sort of
He did invade North Korea, but it didn't work out too well.
It didn't work out too well. the idea that you're going to roll back what the progress that they have right now is really, I think, a pipe dream. For a diplomatic solution, military solutions, as you say, there are no good ones. They all preclude a huge loss of life on that peninsula.
Millions of people, potentially.
Millions of people. Yeah. But if you're going to pursue a diplomatic solution, the question is, who do you talk to? And who's going to talk to them? Amazingly, we still don't have an ambassador even to South Korea. military options do not look good. And I'd say the same thing for the diplomatic solutions right now as well.
Yeah. You know, Paul, I remember Kim Jong-il, the father of Kim Jong-un, was very interested in sort of being legitimized by the United States. And that's why he wanted President Clinton to come there and would have been willing perhaps to cap his program in return for a peace agreement, formal diplomatic relations with the United States. I'm not sure I get that sense from Kim Jong-un. He wants that nuclear power. So the question is it worthwhile for the United States to sit down with him and talk about a freeze? The Chinese and the Russians have put forward the idea of Kim freezing his program as it is with maybe a half dozen nukes and this missile capability in return for freezing the military exercises that the United States does periodically with South Korea.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, and I think you begin by stating a couple of things. One, Kim has not shown an ability to keep past promises. So even if we were to sit down with him, hammer out some kind of agreement, just how much would he stick to that? That's the first thing. The second thing is Kim clearly is seeking recognition, attention, and he also sees his nuclear program. If you talk to North Korea experts, he clearly sees this North Korea program as a form of insurance against a possible American attack. We've never gone to war, thank God, against a country that has nuclear weapons. They clearly have at least 12 to 14, according to U.S. government estimates, and they're clearly capable of building more and building them quickly. So we have to be really, we've never gone to war against a country like that. And that is what he sees in his program. In fact, he sees it, these nuclear weapons, as, again, a form of insurance against what he sees as an American threat. Now, we can possibly sit down and talk to him and hammer out some kind of agreement. The question is, how do you verify it? How do you comply? Would you send in UN inspectors? Would you use, how would you do it?
So there's a lot of things. He doesn't strike me as the type who would accept intrusive inspections into his nuclear facilities. Michael, what about the China card? President Trump has talked, you know, it's for China to figure this out. Although he also said in, I think in Poland, well, maybe the, you know, the Japanese and the South Koreans can figure this out, sort of anybody but him. The Chinese have imposed some sanctions on North Korea, but they've been reluctant to really pull the plug on the North Korean economy. Do you see any sign that that would change?
No. I think that the Chinese interests are in descending order, peace, stability, and nonproliferation on that peninsula. And it is increasingly unclear whether it's a matter of more willingness or ability for the Chinese to control North Korea. There's an assumption
they could stop providing fuel oil. They could stop purchasing anything from North Korea.
They certainly can turn screws. They certainly can put in sanctions. They could certainly make North Korea feel pain. But would that stop them, or would it merely antagonize them and make them increase their efforts more? And you also have this idea of proliferation on two fronts. North Korea is a danger in that it can give this technology to very dangerous elements in this world
and
elsewhere. You also have the issue of, when we were talking earlier about how you negotiate with these guys, do you really legitimize their nuclear program while we ask our allies, Japan and South Korea, you know, to sit on their non-proliferation agreements, which we've done for the last 40 years. So it's difficult.
One thing I should point out, although there is no Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and there is no American ambassador in Seoul, there is a special envoy, Joseph Yoon, who negotiated the release of an American student who became extremely ill and unfortunately died, Otto Warmbier. And so the Trump administration has kept on several of these special envoys. Brett McGurk, who does the ISIS file, is another one. So these folks, I think, are essentially assuming the job of assistant secretary for respective regions in the absence of anybody who's been nominated or confirmed for those positions. But I want to move on to the question of whether the United States is in a position to really mobilize the world behind sanctions or any other kind of concerted effort against North Korea. Paul, Trump is at the G20, first time there, second visit to Europe, and I was struck by the group photo of all the leaders there. You had Angela Merkel, the host, the Chancellor of Germany, in the middle in a bright red jacket, and off to the side, Donald Trump. I mean, it was almost a sort of physical, confirmation of the fact that the United States is not really in step with much of the rest of the G20 on a number of issues, and we'll talk about them, trade, et cetera.
Well, that's true. And just as sort of a backdrop to that, the Pew Global Research Survey, this is an organization here in Washington that conducts various polls and surveys around the world, and they came out with a study last week, in fact, that showed just how far global opinion of the United States has fallen in the last 6 months. Now, gosh, what's been different here in the last 6 months? It's clearly linked to the ascendancy of President Trump. He has plunged in most countries around the world, not in Israel, and interestingly, not in Russia, where he appears to be quite popular. He was in Poland yesterday. He went to Poland because that's one of the countries where he's quite popular. The rest of Europe, though, much of Asia, deeply unpopular. How are you then going to turn to them and say, hey, we need your help with this problem? It makes it harder.
Yeah. Michael, let's talk about the trip to Poland. This preceded Trump's visit to the G20. He gave a speech. Mm-hmm. It was quite a speech. Could you describe it briefly?
I think it was a speech that was made to two constituencies, one being the Polish people and the other being his base here at home. It spoke to the nobility and courage and I guess overall quality of the Polish people. It was very flattering to them and their culture and the ties between Poland and America over the years. It also spoke in very harsh tones about these once again, the alliances that really make up the West.
Hold that thought for a moment. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, and I'm joined by Michael Williams of CBS Radio and Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. This is a reminder. You can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Michael, this notion of will and of Western civilization, on the one hand, I understood it, but there was a kind of unspoken us versus them, and the them was who?
Good question. And that can be interpreted several different ways. What you really heard was Steve Bannon's voice and philosophy here. This is about when most people, especially coming into a G20 conference, talk about the West, if you will, in quotes. They're talking about trade agreements. They're talking about alliances. They're talking about NATO. These sorts of things that have guided
the democracy.
Democracy. Mm-hmm. Yes. These institutions that have guided pretty much the world through the last, let's say, 70 years. And then you have Trumpism and Bannonism call the West. And it's mostly about cultural things. It's about religion. It's about social concepts and constructs. It's a very different thing. So when Donald Trump stands in front of an audience, an international audience, and talks about the West while bashing a former president, Barack Obama, you see him, again, doing things that have never been done by a U.S. president. It's, again, red meat for his base. They love it. It's him, again, exerting this type of a fighter type mm-hmm. of image that he wants to portray, a America first sort of thing. But as America, as you noted, Paul, as America pulls back and as America extracts itself from the international scene, mm-hmm. other players will come in to fill that vacuum in the form of Japan, in the form of China, Germany, France. The world is not going to stand still just because Donald Trump feels that the U.S. isn't making great deals.
Yeah. Speaking of great deals, Paul, the European Union is apparently very close to finalizing a trade agreement with Japan. And, of course, Trump, one of his first acts was to reject the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have included Japan and a number of other Pacific Rim countries. That seemed interesting, the announcement, of course, coming just before the G20.
Well, you know, it's interesting that the president, again, he seems to think that, America can go it alone, America first, which is a phrase that harkens back to the 1930s in a particularly negative and ominous way. And when he says America first, then that means, well, gosh, that means somebody else has to be second. That's not the way the rest of the world now sees it. So he wants to sit down with Germany. And he's visiting France in about a week or so, and all of his friends, Japan and South Korea. If America is first, are all of them second? Is that what he's saying? And if that's so, what incentive do they have to even try and do business with him if they think he's just going to get the upper hand with them? So you see, the result of that is all these other countries in Asia, for example, the TPP. Okay, America's out of that, but that leaves a vacuum now for China, which is filling that gap.
Right.
They're moving ahead with trade deals on their own with all these countries, and we are left on the outside looking in. I'm not quite sure over the long run that's the way to go. As Michael said, it sounds good to Trump's supporters here in the United States, but from a practical matter, I'm not quite sure it's a good idea.
Yeah. Trump also gave a press conference. You were alluding to that in Poland, and he was asked about, once again, if he would definitively say that he accepted the conclusion of U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia interfered in the presidential elections last year.
Yes, it was, again, a reluctance to say
definitively
that the Russians had done this. He said, well, I think his quote was, I think Russia did it, and I think others are involved or could have been involved. And it just raises such suspicions why you won't just definitively say. And if you won't definitively say in a room full of journalists, what are you really going to say, you know, when you walk into the room in the meeting with that leader? Look, during that meeting, there are a number of things that are going to be discussed. There's going to be Syria on the table. There's going to be a bunch of things. But his reluctance to go there is, again, it just raises all sorts of red flags. And we have an investigation going, several investigations going on, so we shall see.
Yeah. Michael, you mentioned Syria and so on. That does seem to be an area where there is an emerging agreement between the U.S. and Russia. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has basically said that it is going to be up to Russia to decide what happens to Assad, the president of Syria, and so on. And this is really a kind of sharp change, even from the Obama administration, which basically acknowledged that Russia would play a major role, but was not entirely ceding ground. And now it seems that once ISIS is defeated, or at least kicked out of Raqqa and so on, that it's going to be largely the Russians and the Iranians that will determine what happens in Syria.
You know, it's a classic example of how, I guess you would say, how skilled Putin is, because he's playing an outsized role.
For the size of his country.
For the size of the country, for the size of the economy. For what it is, for what really is, when you look at the statistics, it really shouldn't be playing that much of a role. But he is a master at becoming the spoiler now. What he's doing in the UN as far as North Korea and not agreeing with resolutions there. He is a global spoiler. And we have a couple of political novices here, let's face it, you know, that in terms of Donald Trump and Rex Tillerson, they are really feeling their way around this thing. They are relative novices on this field. So as their learning curve, you know, is so steep and they're looking to find this thing, things are still moving at a very, very rapid rate. So it's a difficult situation for them in particular.
I want to get to the issue of Qatar, because this is particularly interesting, Paul, on several levels. Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and United Arab Emirates and Egypt have cut relations, blockaded the country. Very strong push against Qatar. They have a list of demands. The Qataris have not agreed to any of these demands. And here again, we have an interesting split, actually, in the Trump administration. Rex Tillerson is flying off to Kuwait to try to manage this crisis, has urged really the Saudis and the Emiratis to tone down their whole campaign. because the United States has a major air base in Qatar. The United States also has economic interests there. ExxonMobil, which Tillerson headed, has major interests in Qatar. But Trump has seemed to be much more on the side of the Saudis. This is a very disturbing crisis to have at a time when the United States is trying to develop some sort of united front against both Iran and ISIS in the region.
He got along quite well with the Saudis when he was there a couple of weeks ago, and lo and behold, he's now, you know, backing them in their efforts against Qatar, even though other elements of the U.S. government, including his own Secretary of State, have said things that have contradicted what the president has said. So if you're in the Middle East, the question is, well, what is the message?
Right.
We're hearing conflicting messages. So, you know, that is a big problem. And as you say, we do have military assets in Qatar.
So more than 10,000 troops at the Al Udeid Air Base.
Yeah, so there's only so much that we can squeeze. You know, we're not going to squeeze them, apparently, because we're on the side of a Qatar. And in terms of the president, by the way, you know, talking about wanting to, you know, contain terrorism and keep the bad guys out of this country. Of course, he got this partial travel ban approved by the Supreme Court. But interestingly, it omits his friends in Saudi Arabia, who
admits
Qatar.
Exactly.
Of course, 15 of the 19 hijackers in 2001 were Saudi. So people say, well, what is the deal with that? So there are all kinds of inconsistencies and unanswered questions. It's all very a tangled web. And I think the big problem here is this lack of consistency with what the president is saying, with what the Secretary of State saying. It's like nobody knows what the real policy is here.
Yeah, yeah. What are the reasons? I mean, there are a number of reasons that the Saudis are angry at Qatar. I think probably the Al Jazeera television network is really the bigger reason, not support for terror or anything like that.
Right? I think that's exactly right. Al Jazeera has been very much in favor of regime change and overthrowing the royal family and that sort of thing, which obviously sort of ruffles the feathers.
Well, in Egypt, I don't know if they were in favor of regime change in Saudi Arabia. But they've given a platform to Arab dissidents to speak in a way that we've never seen before. And this obviously has ruffled Saudi feathers. But I wanted to get to one more issue quickly before we wrap it up today. And, Michael, this is this extraordinary march that's going on in Turkey. You know, the Turks had there was an attempted coup a year ago. It failed. And since that time, 50,000 people have been jailed, including 12 members of parliament and more than 150 journalists. 150,000 people have been fired from their jobs. There's been a referendum in which Erdogan, the president of Turkey, has assumed basically dictatorial powers.
Yeah.
And now we have the head of the CHP, the Republican People's Party, leading this 250-mile, 23-day march after one of his MPs, top MPs, was jailed. They're carrying signs that say Adalet, justice. How should we interpret this? I mean, it is certainly the biggest protest that has happened against Erdogan in the last year.
Well, Erdogan has established himself really as a dictator. You know, there's no question about that. You know, at home and abroad, even with his behavior here on his trip and ordering the beatings of protesters here in the United States soil, which is something I have never seen before.
Horrible.
Look, Turkey is an important player in the Middle East. It's an important player in Europe. It's very key. Now, whether these protests actually lead to a pulling back or a recession of his, you know, attempt to grab more and more power for extended periods of time, we don't know. But for me, it's great to see that still that spirit of dissidence is there. You know, we can count on people to come out and fight this thing for right now. Hopefully, there will not be terribly violent reactions to this.
Yeah, I should say as we speak that there was a survey done showing that one out of three residents of Washington, D.C. has also participated in a protest this year.
Wow.
So there's something going on.
Wow.
There's something going on all around the world. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Carol Castiel. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.